This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It looks like the so-called Bush Six may have some company. Last month, a Spanish court opened an investigation into six Bush administration lawyers alleged to have provided the legal framework for the torture of detainees at Gitmo. Torture is a violation of international law. Today, the judge who opened that case, Baltasar Garzon, Spain's top investigative magistrate, opened a new investigation into alleged policymakers behind torture and those who gave torture orders. Garzon has not named who the targets will be. My guest, Philippe Sands, is the author of the book Torture Team. It comes out in paperback in May. Sands is an international lawyer who has been involved in many international torture cases. The Spanish lawyer who filed the criminal complaint against the Bush Six said that Sands' book helped show him who should be the targets of the investigation. The Bush Six are Alberto Gonzalez, former Attorney General, Jay Bybee and John Yoo, formerly of the Office of Legal Counsel, who wrote the so-called torture memos, William Haynes, former general counsel for the Defense Department, David Addington, former legal advisor and chief of staff for Dick Cheney, and Doug Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. I spoke with Philippe Sands this morning, minutes after Judge Garzon handed down his decision. Philippe Sands, welcome back to Fresh Air. Can you explain what action the Spanish court took today?
Well, as you know, there's been a slightly long, convoluted process. The most recent decision of Judge Garzon is to confirm that he will proceed to a criminal investigation in relation to five individuals who are Spaniards or residents of Spain for abuse and torture of those individuals at Guantanamo and at other places. He has extended his investigation beyond the Bush Six, it will include the Bush Six, to any other person who may have been involved in the decision to subject those five individuals to abuse and torture.
Of all the countries in the world, why is it a Spanish court that is taking action against the United States for torture?
Well, to step back slightly, under the 1984 Convention Against Torture, any one of the 150 or so states' parties who have an obligation to investigate the crime of torture could exercise jurisdiction over events occurring in Guantanamo, in Bagram, or in Abu Ghraib, which constitute torture. My understanding is that this latest decision by Judge Garzon is based squarely on the treatment of five individuals of Spanish nationality or who were residents in Spain who alleged that they were abused at Guantanamo and in other places in circumstances in which the Spanish courts have already found that they were so abused and possibly even tortured. So Spain has apparently a pretty clear connection with five individuals, and that appears to be the basis. But it's important, I think, to stress that Spain is not the only country that is conducting a criminal investigation. My own country, the United Kingdom, right now is carrying out a criminal investigation in relation to the circumstances in which allegations of abuse and torture against a British resident, Binyam Mohamed, occurred.
So my understanding is that Judge Garzon, who is the judge handling the Spanish investigation, it sounds like he may be very frustrated because the five terrorist suspects he wanted to prosecute, the information incriminating them has to be thrown out of court because it was gotten through torture and therefore isn't admissible in court. So he's probably pretty frustrated that his case has fallen apart because of that.
Well, that's right. What seems to have happened is that several years ago, Judge Garzon decided to bring charges of crimes, terrorism-related crimes, against these five individuals. When they got out of Guantanamo, he proceeded with his effort to prosecute them for various crimes. And that case collapsed because they successfully argued they'd been tortured and abused, and so the material on which he relied, apparently, had been obtained in circumstances in which it was not admissible in court proceedings. And against that background, his effort to bring a case, ironically enough, against individuals he considered to have committed crimes which constituted terrorism, collapsed. And that is the context. And it is that case, which was closed 2 or 3 years ago, which has now been reopened and ironically turned around to address the individuals who, in effect, he now believes caused his case to collapse.
So now that he's broadened his case to include people higher up in the Bush administration, beyond the six lawyers who are now known as the Bush Six, is it a more consequential case now that it's broadened? Does the meaning of the case, does the impact of the case change now?
I don't think that it necessarily does. The underlying issues are essentially the same. I mean, under the Convention Against Torture, under the Geneva Conventions, complicity or participation in torture, which can include those who framed the legal decisions as well as those who took the policy decisions, would essentially be the same issues. He will still face issues of establishing causality, connections between the advice given by individuals and the actual harm, if it is established, to particular individuals. So the essential issues are the same. But of course, once you've gone beyond the sort of second and third category individuals, who I think played a very important role, the lawyers, in my view, a key role, you become even more politically significant, I think, when you go up the scale to include some of the individuals who were obviously very closely involved with the administration. So I think politically it raises the stakes.
So you have information saying that Condi Rice is likely to be named in this second round?
I don't think his decision names particular individuals, but what I'm told is that the Intelligence Services Committee list what was relevant and that her name, and I believe also Vice President Cheney's name, is on that list. So he too may be in Garzon's mind. I mean, Garzon has drafted it very broadly, any person who was directly involved in the decision which led to the abuse of these individuals. So it goes very high, but it also goes very low.
So is there any precedent for naming people this high in a criminal investigation from another country if the person wasn't an out-and-out dictator like Augusto Pinochet of Chile?
Well, there are examples, but I think they're not as, shall we say, grounded in fact and law. I think this is a different type of situation. It is potentially very far-reaching, but of course the problem that we all face in this, and we're all struggling with this because the US is a well-functioning democracy. We are where we are because of decisions of the Supreme Court, because a democratically elected president has released documents, is that we've got pretty much black and white evidence that torture happened, coupled with an obligation to criminally investigate torture. And what is almost unique here is an admission by a state, an important state, a very important state, that it has engaged in torture. And that is what causes, I think, a lot of these real political dilemmas and difficulties.
You use the word obligation to investigate.
You have an obligation. It's very clear in the 1984 Convention Against Torture, in Articles 5 and 6 and 7, that if a person who is alleged to have been involved in torture is located within your jurisdiction, you have a legal obligation either to subject them to criminal investigation or to extradite them to a third state. Now, ironically, and this is very ironic, it's just in the past few months that the United States has for itself, for the first time, exercised rights of criminal jurisdiction over a person who committed torture abroad. A non-American, name of Chucky Taylor, the son of Charles Taylor, was convicted, I think last October, by a U.S. federal court of the crime of torture in Sierra Leone and in Liberia. And he was then sentenced in January, I think, to 97 years in prison. And there's a wonderful press release by the former Attorney General, Mr. Mukasey, warmly welcoming the exercise by the United States of jurisdiction and the conviction of this individual for the crime of torture abroad. So, ironically, there's even support at the upper echelons of the former Bush administration for this type of universal jurisdictions that's come to be called.
So now that Judge Garzon has widened this investigation, in order for him to actually prosecute anybody who he's investigating, they'd have to be extradited from the United States to Spain. I think it's fair to say there's no way that President Obama is going to extradite either the six lawyers or anyone higher than that, certainly not Condoleezza Rice, to Spain for prosecution. So what's the significance of this case, considering that there's probably no way in the world that anyone will actually be prosecuted?
Well, I should say at the outset, I'm not an expert in Spanish criminal procedure, so I want to be very careful to stress that. But I understand that what is likely to happen next is that the investigation will be followed reasonably shortly assuming it proceeds without any sort of appeals. And it may well be that the Spanish prosecutors or the government may appeal his decision earlier this week. But if it proceeds unappealed and unhindered, what is likely to happen is that a court date will be set. And the individuals whom he is targeting following the conclusion of his investigation will be invited to attend that court hearing. If they decide not to attend the court hearing, which is, of course, the most likely scenario, the next thing he is able to do is to issue an arrest warrant. And he can then circulate that arrest warrant internationally. And at the very least, what it would mean is that those individuals would be, assuming how widely the arrest warrant is circulated internationally, subject to arrest if they entered a country in which that arrest warrant had validity. So that's the most likely medium-term scenario. Added to that, he can, of course, make a request for extradition. But, of course, the U.S.-Spain extradition treaty includes an exception in relation to nationals of each country. And so I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see extraditions from the United States to Spain.
So President Obama has a legal way out here. He can say the extradition treaty says that American nationals do not need to be extradited. You can just say no to that. So he can just legally say no.
I'm going to very boringly put in another caveat. I'm not an expert on U.S. extradition law, so I want to be careful what I say. But I just had a quick look at the extradition treaty, and it has that exception. So what that appears to mean is that at least under that treaty, there is no obligation to extradite. But of course, there are also obligations to extradite under various other treaties and obligations to assist in criminal investigations, including under the 1984 Convention against Torture, and there are related provisions in the Geneva Convention. So it's not quite as black and white. And I think that what this is going to cause President Obama's administration to do is, again, face one of these difficult balancing exercises. It has put itself squarely in the seat of being a rule of law administration. You get a request from a third country for assistance on a crime involving senior officials of a former administration. What on earth do you do?
What impact do you think that the recently released memos pertaining to the interrogation techniques and also the recently released Senate Armed Services Committee report had on the Spanish court's decision to add more people to their criminal investigation?
Well, we don't know the full details, but it looks as though it's had a pretty significant impact because some of these documents may well have coloured Judge Garzón's sense of how far to reach in terms of looking at particular individuals. So if he is looking at reports that have been published by the Attorney General or the Senate Intelligence Committee or by the Senate Armed Services Committee and using those to frame his own investigation, then you can see that the act of release of the documents is having, ironically, the consequence of adding fuel to foreign investigations. And I think this adds to the context in which President Obama, of course, will face very real difficulties. I think his decision to release those documents was brave, and I think it was the right decision, and I think he's justifiably earned plaudits around the world for doing that. And I think it's also important to remember that whatever foreign courts or judges may do, ultimately they will, I am dead certain, adopt the position that if the United States carries out its own investigation, and it's a half-serious investigation, other countries will back off.
Now, your book, Torture Team, is coming out in paperback. And my understanding is that this book was very influential on the lawyer who is prosecuting this case in Spain, and that lawyer is Gonzalo Boye, and also, I think, on Judge Garzón, because you mentioned in your book that you showed some documents to a European judge. I'm guessing that's Judge Garzón.
Well, you're free to guess.
Okay, but you're not going to say. But okay.
I've indicated in the main body of the book, which is already available, that I went to see a European judge and a European prosecutor, and for obvious reasons, I undertook to respect their confidentiality. But you'll want to be aware, and your listeners will want to be aware, that obviously I, as a European international lawyer, have contacts with a large number of prosecutors and lawyers and judges in various countries. And I was, for example, acting for a Belgian prosecutor in the Pinochet case, and I've had extensive contact with Italian, Spanish, German, French, Swedish, Swiss prosecutors. So I want to respect confidentiality.
That's fine, but I will say that the memos that you showed whatever European judge it was are very relevant to the case that the Spanish court is prosecuting now, whether you showed it to the Spanish people or not. So let's talk about a couple of those memos that you think implicate some of the people in what is now known as the Bush Six, the lawyers who the Spanish court is prosecuting for providing legal framework for torture. And a couple of these memos pertain to Jim Haynes, who was a lawyer with the Pentagon under Donald Rumsfeld. Would you describe one or two of those memos that you think are significant and give examples of how you think Haynes helped provide legal framework for torture?
Sure. What I'd done, in fact, as I described in the book when it initially came out, I wanted a sort of reality check to all the material that I'd gathered in my interview. So I went and found a European judge and prosecutor and put the material that I had. That was about the summer of 2007. After the book came out, there were hearings, new material came out, and I thought it would be sensible to go back and reconvene that reality check. And so I went back to the same European judge and the same European prosecutor with all these new documents that had come out. One of the documents showed, for example, and this concerned the testimony of a person who had been the main lawyer for General Myers, who was the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, a lady by the name of Admiral Jane Dalton. And she testified that when the request from Guantanamo had originally come up, she had done what she normally did. She sent it out for review to the military services and their lawyers. And within a couple of days, all of the services, Air Force, Navy, Marine, Army, came back and just said, look, we can't do these techniques of interrogation. This is not us. This is criminal. This is torture. You cannot do it. She then sent those documents over to Mr. Haynes' office of the General Counsel at the Department of Defense. And the next thing she knew, very promptly, and she described this on questioning to Senator Warner and Senator Levin and others, was that Mr. Haynes intervened to stop her review. Now, that is enormously significant for any person who's looking at bringing a criminal charge, because what it destroys is the idea that Mr. Haynes was involved in some sort of good faith lawyering. What it indicates is that when contrary legal advice was put forward, which said these types of techniques were inappropriate, he took active steps to snuff out that legal advice. And that, I suspect, is really going to come back to haunt him.
Let me just quote you something that Jay Bybee said yesterday.
This morning, yeah.
Let me preface this by saying Jay Bybee was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the office that advises the executive branch on what is legal and what is not. And he was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel when the so-called torture memos were written, and he signed those memos. So he said, the central question for lawyers was a narrow one. Locate under the statutory definition the thin line between harsh treatment of a high-ranking al-Qaeda terrorist that is not torture and harsh treatment that is. I believed at the time and continue to believe today that the conclusions were legally correct. We gave our best honest advice based on our good faith analysis of the law. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I was shocked when I read that. I would have hoped that a man like Jay Bybee, who is a federal judge, would have had the honor and decency to say, with the passage of the time and on the basis of reflection, I now recognize that I fell into error. I accept my responsibility for having done that. I should not have signed that memo. He hasn't done that. He's dug himself into an even deeper hole. I suspect he's done it because he is right now under investigation by the Office of Professional Responsibility at the Department of Justice and perhaps by his own bar association, and there may even be impeachment proceedings against him. I think the braver and more honourable thing to do would have been to recognise that he fell into error. And I have to say, reading that interview, for the first time, I felt really very strongly that this is not a gentleman who really ought to be sitting on the bench of a US federal court. I mean, sitting here in London, I have to tell you, US federal courts are immensely respected institutions. It's not a political thing. It's not a left-right thing. These are hugely important courts that our English courts look to, that foreign courts look to, and the idea that a lawyer who signed off on waterboarding and still thinks today that it is not torture should sit on such a court is frankly distressing and I would say even shocking.
Now, the Spanish lawyer, Gonzalo Boye, who is prosecuting the case against the so-called Bush Six, six of the lawyers involved with providing the legal framework for what has been called torture. He told Jane Mayer of The New Yorker that your book, Torture Team, played a big role in his thinking and that your book showed him who the targets of the investigation should be. What role do you think your book has played in the Spanish court's investigation into American torture? And how do you feel about whatever role you think your book has played?
Well, I think it's probably for others to judge what exactly the role has been and whether that's a positive or a negative thing. I suppose at the back of my mind, I imagined that at some point in the future, something may happen. But I've been immensely surprised at the speed with which things have happened and have been almost overwhelmed, I've got to say, in the last 2 weeks, particularly as President Obama has released documents and then has appeared to endorse at least my underlying thesis by saying the responsibility of the framers of the legal decision is a matter for the Attorney General, not a matter for the President, which appears to open the door to at least the possibility of criminal investigations.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you again, Tara, and thank you for following in on this, because I've really appreciated the opportunity to talk fairly on these rather complex but interesting issues.
Philippe Sands recorded from the BBC in London this morning. His book, Torture Team, will be published in paperback in May. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may be surprised to hear what some top people in the Bush administration and CIA say they didn't know about the brutal interrogation techniques they authorized. My guest, Scott Shane, co-wrote an investigative article about this with Mark Mazzetti in the New York Times. Shane is a national security correspondent based in Washington and has been covering, among other things, the recent release of Bush administration interrogation memos. Scott Shane, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start by just reading the opening of an article that I found really shocking that you wrote last week. And here's the opening. In a series of high-level meetings in 2002, without a single dissent from cabinet members or lawmakers, the U.S. for the first time officially embraced the brutal methods of interrogation it had always condemned. This extraordinary consensus was possible largely because no one involved, not the top two CIA officials who were pushing the program, not the senior aides to President George Bush, not the leaders of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, investigated the gruesome origins of the techniques they were approving. What didn't they know about these techniques?
Well, what the CIA officials failed to include in their briefings was the origin of the SEER program, this military training program. Under different names, it's existed since the 50s, and it came out of the experience in the Korean War, in which American pilots were taken prisoner, held by the Chinese, and subjected to a lot of harsh interrogation methods. And some of them ultimately gave false confessions to various war crimes. And this caused a huge upset in the military and with the public. And there was this notion that the communists somehow had secret brainwashing techniques. So a lot of people were assigned with government money, mostly from the Defense Department, to study the question of what did the Chinese do to force these false confessions out of American prisoners. And what they found was there was no secret, sophisticated brainwashing. It was just shackling people in stress positions, forcing them to stand for days on end, keeping them in cold cells, that kind of thing. And that had the result of breaking them down and causing them to essentially do whatever they were asked to do. And in this case, they were asked to confess to war crimes. The military then wanted to essentially prepare high-risk personnel, flyers, special operations troops, and certain categories of folks who were seen at high risk of capture, and give them a taste of these kinds of methods. This is all during the Cold War still. So that not so that they could withstand the methods exactly, but so that they wouldn't come as such a shock, and they would perhaps be able to resist better. And this became a standard part of military training. It was fairly secret, but it was operated by several branches of the military services in a number of locations around the country. And the Navy included in its interrogation methods in this training program waterboarding, the now infamous interrogation method where a person is strapped to a board with the head beneath the feet, the mouth and nose are covered with a cloth, and someone pours water over the cloth to create a sort of panic sensation of suffocation and drowning. And sometimes people ingest water, and they would do that as part of their training. So all these methods became sort of institutionalized in this military training program. And I'm told that many people even involved with the program sort of lost track of or never heard about the origins.
So you found that most of the people who signed off on this program and who went along with this program, who practiced the program, had no idea of the origins of the program, which is why there was no disagreement about its use. Were you able to find out who decided to use the SEER program as a way to interrogate high-value suspects?
Yes. Well, what we were told was that the CIA, when it was given the job of capturing and questioning high-level al-Qaeda suspects by President Bush, had very little interrogation experience. They had some experience assessing what they call walk-ins, someone who walks into an embassy somewhere and says, I want to spy for the United States. So they were somewhat used to questioning people and judging whether they're being deceptive. But in terms of a purely hostile interrogation, where you capture someone in virtually a military situation, they had very little experience. The FBI had a lot of experience, and the military had some experience. CIA had very little. So the CIA reached out to a number of foreign intelligence agencies and asked them how they interrogated folks. And they reached out to this military training program, the SEER program. And there were some enthusiastic psychologists from the SEER program who came over to CIA, became consultants, and convinced top CIA officials that this was the way to go, that these were the methods that should be used.
Didn't the psychologists who work with the SEER program know that its original use was to extract false confessions?
That is an answer we don't have yet. There was a guy named James Mitchell, who's a PhD psychologist who worked for years. He was in the Air Force on active duty. Then he was a civilian employee of the Defense Department as a SEER psychologist. He had monitored thousands of these mock interrogations that were carried out as part of the training program, but he'd never actually carried out an interrogation, a real interrogation himself. But he apparently is a very convincing guy, and he came to the CIA and said, this is what you want to do, and this is how it works, and explained the whole thing. Whether he knew and kept to himself the origins of the program, whether he shared the origins of the program with some folks at CIA, is still unknown. We haven't been able to find that out. But one thing we have been told with some authority is that the top two officials of the CIA, George Tenet, the director, and John McLaughlin, his deputy, who were the main people, went over to the White House to explain these methods and sell them, so to speak, to the rest of the government, themselves have told colleagues that they had no idea, first, the origins of the SEER program, and second, they didn't have any idea about the rather lurid history of waterboarding in particular, because waterboarding in various forms has been used by virtually every despotic regime as a torture method, going back to the Spanish Inquisition and even before that. And the top CIA officials who were proposing waterboarding to the rest of the government themselves have told people they had no idea about that history.
Do you find that kind of amazing?
Yes, my colleague Mark Mazzetti and I found that quite amazing. We were somewhat skeptical about it, and we kept reporting, talked to a lot of people, and finally became convinced that that was the case. There was this possibility that rather than say, I knew that waterboarding was used by Pol Pot under the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and that there is a Pol Pot's waterboard is preserved there in the Genocide Museum in Phnom Penh, rather than say they knew that, it might be more politically advantageous to say, geez, I didn't know anything about that. But when you consider the sort of rush and pressure under which these decisions were made, and when you talk to enough people, you actually, we did convince ourselves that this was true. They really didn't know. In a way, they were saying, we weren't evil. We were ignorant. And that seems to be holding up so far.
Here's another question that's been raised. Since the SEER program was known by anyone who actually knew it to have been used by the communists to extract false confessions from Americans, that perhaps the SEER program was intentionally being used to tried to extract false confessions from al-Qaeda suspects. Let me paraphrase something from the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee report that was recently released that was investigating these brutal or torture techniques. And this is from Major Paul Burney, who was a U.S. Army psychiatrist assigned to interrogation at Gitmo in the summer of 2002. And he said that there was pressure on interrogators to prove the connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda, to prove that there was a connection. And he said that there was more and more pressure to resort to measures that might produce that kind of answer. And the implication here is that there was pressure to use harsher and harsher techniques in order to get the information that the Bush administration wanted, the information that, yes, there's a connection. And this was before the invasion of Iraq. So some people are saying that, yeah, we used these SEER techniques intentionally to get false confessions of a connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda to help the Bush administration justify the impending invasion of Iraq. So I wonder if you feel that connecting those dots has any justification based on what you've learned.
I think not. I think it's sort of two different issues. And also, of course, Guantanamo was by and large a Defense Department operation rather than a CIA operation. The waterboarding and so on was done at the CIA's secret prisons. It is certainly true, as far as I can tell, that the CIA adopted these methods with very little investigation of their history in producing false confessions. And you would think that that would have worried them a great deal, but I do think that they were sincerely at that point desperately trying to detect the next attack. This is still in the months after September 11th, and there was a feeling widely shared, certainly by many Americans, that there could be more attacks coming. And the CIA was terrified that one of these prisoners that they caught would know about the plot and they wouldn't get the information. I think that was a different track from the pressure that began to build to come up with reasons to invade Iraq. That, of course, has been well documented. And there is one torture-related element to that. In late 2001, the United States caught a guy named Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who, after a bit of a dispute between the FBI and CIA, the CIA shipped off to Egypt to be interrogated. There, according to a number of reports, he was subjected to torture and invented some information about ties between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, which fed back into the case for war. But I think it's perhaps a little too devious to imagine that they were torturing these guys in hopes that they would falsely confess to something that would strengthen the case for war. You know, if you were going to go to those kinds of lengths in inventing evidence, you could just invent the evidence. You could falsify documents. I don't think you'd have to torture people in, you know, until they said what you wanted. But, of course, all this remains a bit of a black box, and we don't really know the details of either the motivations or what really happened in some of these interrogations, both at Guantanamo and at the secret prisons.
Now, you're saying that even people at the top of the CIA, even George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA, didn't know the origins of the SEER techniques, which was the basis of the U.S. Harsh interrogations or brutal or torture or whatever word you prefer. So if people at the top of the CIA didn't know the history of SEER and of these techniques, what about the lawyers at the Justice Department who were justifying these techniques? Do you have any idea whether they knew the history of the SEER program or whether they knew the history of waterboarding and how it dated back to the Spanish Inquisition?
I don't know for sure. We now have, of course, a series of memos, two of them written in August 2002 and mainly by John Yoo, one of the Justice Department lawyers, and signed by Jay Bybee, his boss, and then three more written in 2005 and signed by Stephen Bradbury, who had come to the Office of Legal Counsel at Justice subsequently. So we can read those memos, But it's, of course, impossible to know whether their authors knew certain information that they deliberately kept out or whether they just had no idea. One thing that's particularly striking about the Bradbury memos in 2005, which were not written under quite the pressure of the August 2002 memos, is that they omit to tell the CIA, this is legal advice to the CIA, they omit to tell the CIA that waterboarding was one of the war crimes investigated in the Tokyo trials against the Japanese, carried out by the United States against the Japanese after World War II. There are descriptions, there was testimony from American prisoners who were waterboarded by the Japanese. You would think that that kind of history of prosecution would be an important thing to include in a memo advising the CIA and whether they were getting in trouble using these methods. And in addition to that, there was even a domestic case of a sheriff in Texas, I believe, which had been appealed, so there was an appellate record of a waterboarding prosecution that also could have been included in those memos, and they were not. Whether, again, this is a question of somebody not knowing or knowing and deliberately keeping it out, you know, remains to be seen. There's an ethics investigation of Mr. Bradbury, Mr. Yu, and Mr. Bybee that it has been conducted for several years now by the Ethics Office of the Justice Department, and it's supposed to come out in the next couple of months, I'm told. So perhaps we'll learn the details.
One of the things we learned from the recently released Senate Armed Services Committee report is that Abu Zubaydah, one of the high-value al-Qaeda suspects, was waterboarded 83 times in 1 month, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, another high-value al-Qaeda suspect who is believed to be the mastermind behind 9/11, was waterboarded 183 times in 1 month. And I'm wondering if you have any idea whether there's any historical precedent for waterboarding one person so many times in such short a period of time. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what it says about the people doing the waterboarding that if it doesn't work, that you would just keep trying it over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Well, those numbers came as a shock to a lot of people, including reporters like me who've spent a lot of time looking into this program, partly because a former CIA officer who was involved in catching Abu Zubaydah, John Kiriakou, had said, first on ABC News and then to a bunch of us, including me, that Abu Zubaydah had been waterboarded for 30 seconds before breaking, essentially, and agreeing to tell everything, and that after that he just sat down and told everything he knew. And so to learn that that was wrong, and that in fact they had waterboarded Abu Zubaydah 83 times, was sort of remarkable. The only defense, I guess you could say, that I've heard of that since then was from a CIA official who spoke on condition of anonymity. And what he said was, this method did not turn out to be the sort of magical technique that it had been sold as. It was sold as something that you would do to someone for, you know, 30 seconds or 2 minutes, and they would panic and they'd be so frightened that they would then sit down and tell you everything. But they used it until someone would agree to talk, and they wouldn't be, in other words, sort of shouting their answers in the style of the TV show 24 from the waterboard. One set of guys would waterboard Abu Zubaydah or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and when the prisoner said, okay, you know, I've had enough, I'll talk, sometimes hours would pass before he would be put in another place in a more comfortable setting with an interrogator who would then ask him questions. So the defense was that this was used to sort of break resistance and get these guys to agree to talk as opposed to having them sort of shouting out answers under pressure. But I think it's raised grave questions about the claims that this is a very effective interrogation method. One of these legal memorandums that came out last week also revealed that the CIA Inspector General, in a still-secret report from 2004 had found that some of these techniques, and in particular waterboarding, had been used in ways that violated the Justice Department's guidelines. The Justice Department said these methods are legal, these methods are not torture, but that was based on the rules that were supposed to be governing their use. And the CIA Inspector General in 2004 found that both in terms of frequency and in terms of the volume of water used, that the interrogators had exceeded the guidelines that they were given by the Justice Department.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Shane. He's a national security reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and we're talking about some of the new information about the brutal interrogation techniques that the United States has used. Former Vice President Dick Cheney and some others are still saying that these techniques worked. And you write that even the most exacting truth commission may have a hard time determining for certain whether brutal interrogations conducted by the CIA help keep the country safe. Why do you think it will be so hard to determine for sure if these techniques actually resulted in information that helped deter terrorist plots?
Well, I think there's strong evidence that valuable information came from this program, and ultimately led to the capture of a lot of key al-Qaeda leaders, and that probably prevented future attacks. But whether these particular methods were necessary to get that information is a very different question. It's sort of an uncontrolled experiment. They used these methods, and they got the information. Many experienced FBI and military interrogators will tell you that they believe you could have gotten the same information, possibly more information, using traditional rapport-building methods. They don't think these harsh methods were necessary, and they think they risked producing false information as well.
But wasn't some of the information from, for instance, Abu Zubaydah gotten before these techniques even started, when there was just more traditional rapport-building interrogation?
Absolutely. There were two FBI agents who began questioning Abu Zubaydah before the CIA team arrived, and they got a number of very important revelations from him, not only not using the brutal methods, but actually caring for him. He'd been shot when he was captured, and so he was in pain, and they actually did sort of personal medical care for him and talked to him and got him to give up some very valuable information. By some accounts, the most valuable information was given up before they began any of these harsh techniques.
I'd like to hear what you think were one or two of the most important revelations that came out of either the memos that were recently released or the Senate Military Affairs Committee report that was recently released.
Well, I think from the memos, perhaps the single most shocking fact was that waterboarding was used so frequently against two prisoners, 83 times against Abu Zubaydah and 183 times against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. That certainly calls into question claims that some CIA officials had made about how effective waterboarding was in getting people to talk. From the Senate Armed Services report, I think one of the interesting revelations was that at a low level, a number of the SEER program trainers who were very familiar with these techniques warned in emails and in memos that they should not be used on an offensive basis, that they were essentially the enemy's techniques, and they were only part of a training program to give American military personnel some sense of what they might face at the hands of the enemy. They had always been considered historically to be torture and not to be effective as interrogation techniques. They'd been proven to generate, in some cases, false confessions. But these were relatively lower-level people who were sending off these warnings. And as far as I can tell, they reached no one at a high level in the CIA, and they were ignored by some high-level military officials who got them.
Do you think that there would be serious obstacles to criminal prosecution in the United States?
Yes, most lawyers say that there's a huge obstacle to criminal prosecution for anyone from President Bush all the way down to the lowest level interrogator, and that is that the highest authority on the law in the executive branch, which is the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, in writing told these folks that what they were doing was legal. That would seem to be to make prosecuting them very, very difficult. The only exceptions to that would be possibly the lawyers who wrote the memos themselves, if they were found to have acted in bad faith to essentially say that these methods were legal when they knew them to be illegal, or some interrogators who are said by the CIA Inspector General to have exceeded the guidelines by waterboarding people with greater volumes of water and greater frequency than they were permitted to do. That might also give some kind of an opening for prosecution. In general, I think most experienced prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys are very skeptical that anyone will actually be prosecuted for the for these acts.
Well, Scott Shane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Scott Shane is a national security correspondent in the New York Times Washington Bureau. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Thank you.